Now entering Nerdist.com.
This episode is sponsored by AdamandEve.com. Hey, and they want me to ask you a question. Are you getting enough? I bet you'd love more, right? Well, AdamandEve.com wants to give you more with 10 free gifts. First, you'll get a sexy surprise for a female-bodied humanoid, a second specially selected toy for a male-bodied humanoid, and third, well, that's something that every humanoid can enjoy. Plus, you'll get 6 full-length adult human movie DVDs. Hey, and number 10, free shipping on your entire order. So what do you have to do to get your 10 free gifts? It's not hard. Just go to AdamandEve.com and select any one item. It could be an adventurous new toy, costume piece, lingerie, hey, anything you want. Just enter offer code SEXNERD at checkout. That's the important part. That's how you get your 10 free gifts. So go check out AdamandEve.com today, select one item, and get 10 free gifts. Just type in SEXNERD at AdamandEve.com. Woohoo! Free shipping.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra Podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
Sex nerds. Hey, Sandra Doherty here. I am excited about this episode. Yes, you know what? I feel like while this is not the first polyamory episode we've covered, I am excited about it because there are several relationship communication ideas, concepts that I haven't been presented before. Or maybe it's just being presented to me in a way that it finally sank in, but I find this episode valuable. There's lots of tools for successful relationships within it. And of course, as a budding type of relationship style in the world, I feel like polyamory is interesting to check in with every once in a while. So the authors of More Than Two are on the show. Also, I have a story to tell you. It's about a dance-a-thon I was at this past weekend. So I volunteer sometimes for 826 LA. It's a tutoring center for literacy in the LA area. They have a time travel store. There's one in several cities, superhero stores and pirate stores, and it's a lot of fun. I won a gift basket in the raffle. Thank you. It was fun. It was all these journals. It's like, Sandra, be creative. Here's a bunch of paper. So I win this awesome gift basket and this woman runs up to me afterward and she's like, Sandra? And I look and it's Mari from the episode where we talked about the girl who gets hit on all the time and people follow her down the street. They fall in love with her. They tell her their life stories. They're always oversharing with her and she doesn't know what it is. Well, she didn't know what it was. So during the conversation in the episode, I said, well, I don't generally get hit on ever. And some of the things that I've noticed that I have naturally done over the years, naturally, or I learned it to protect myself, is super serious face, like super Tomb Raider bitch face, and then no eye contact. And so she said to me is, guess what? People don't do the thing anymore. They don't follow me around and they don't hit on me because I practiced no eye contact and bitch face. And now it's better. So the fact that one of our guests on this show took in with the things that I've done in my life and now she doesn't get hit on all. It's like, oh, and that tells me a lot about my own life. Anyway, eye contact. I mean, if you tend to stare at the ground a lot, just a little bit. Anyway, I really am glad that you get to be part of this conversation that we're about to listen to. In terms of dates, honestly, I talk at Caltech in November for Dating 201. 101 was a lot of fun. Other than that, I am trying to just keep my November real clear. I want room for projects and things in the home front. I just want to I've been traveling a lot this summer. So New York, DC, I've been all around the last few months. And right now I'm looking forward to a very cozy Halloween, and then an awesome November. So there's going to be more episodes, and next week's Halloween episode is a doozy. I cannot wait for you to listen to it, and I'm not going to tell you what it is until next week. Ha 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 ha. Okay. Many consensual hugs and a high five, and let's start the show.
Can you hear me?
I can. This is really strange.
It is.
I can hear me too.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
How exciting. Why is this so strange? You've been on, what was it? You're on a book tour right now. Mm-hmm. We're talking polyamory, you guys. I probably told you that in the intro, but I'm saying it again. Hi, Eve. Hi, Franklin. Welcome to the table.
Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here.
You're on a book tour for More Than Two, this book you just wrote on polyamory. You just told me before we started that you've been on 13 different events. Have they mainly been live in front of live audiences?
Yes.
I see. So you never get the headphones where you can hear yourself.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We did a podcast with Cunning Minx for Poly Weekly during the crowdfunding campaign, and we did a radio interview right at the launch of the book tour, but it didn't have the earphones where, you know, everything is piped directly.
Technology
to you.
Is freaky.
Yeah.
I like it. I like, it feels like I'm in a safe womb space. No matter where I am, if I can hear myself through headphones, it's like, it's all going to be okay. So, tell me all the things. You've written a book, More Than Two, A Practical Guide to Ethical Polyamory by Franklin Vo and Eve Rickert.
Yes.
Did I say them both correctly?
You did.
That might be a first time in my life. The Ford with Janet Hardy, who was co-author of The Ethical Slut. That's exciting. So what's the deal, you guys? Because you wrote a book. It's huge. It's a beautiful cover. Why write a book about polyamory? We've got several on the market. What's the deal?
Nobody was saying the things that we wanted to say. Mm-hmm. There are 30 mumble books about polyamory out there already, and nobody was talking about the important stuff, and we decided we needed to do something about that.
What's the important stuff?
Two things. How to actually make it work, because a lot of people talk, you know, poly theory, and this is how poly is wonderful, and this is how you should do things, but nobody talks about really nitty-gritty problem solving, and nobody really seems to get into a lot about ethics, and everybody says, oh, polyamory is ethical non-monogamy, and then don't really discuss ethics.
Okay, so this book is focused on where you see, because obviously there's a lot to cover just in relationships. I mean, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of books on the market just about relationships and marriage and all those things. So, of course, we're probably going to.
But you only need one. And that's ours.
Oh.
Well, that's not really true. We list how many books? We list about 10 books in our resources section that we recommend.
So you only need 11.
Right.
Okay, 11 books. Put them on your list. Look at the back of More Than Two. Figure it out. Okay, so that's really exciting. The ethics. I actually have been talking to a lot of sex educators lately about how I'm concerned that there's not a lot of conversation around ethics in sex ed, or pleasurable sex ed. So that's something I've been looking at for my own work. I'm looking at the contents. What is polyamory? A poly toolkit, poly frameworks, the poly reality, and the poly ecosystem. Resources on page 469. Write that down, you guys, for later. Okay. I looked up your website, which has a wonderful free resources right there on your website. And both of your bios at the very beginning is like, hey, my name's Franklin. I've made a lot of mistakes. Hey, I'm Eve. I've made a lot of mistakes as well. Like, I thought that was so funny that was like how you you know, laid it all out there. And I think that's really brave and honest. And really, let's be serious. I mean, I have done my dabbling in the polyamory sphere, and I have made so many mistakes that I thought I knew better. Like, because I knew that other people make those mistakes. Mm-hmm. So like, I was a little bit different. Like, you know, and then like, oh my God, this is textbook stupid. What? So how long have each of you been doing the poly?
I've been poly. Well, my first poly relationship started about 6 years ago now, and my husband and I started about 4 years before that, decided about 4 years before that to open our relationship and started sort of researching and negotiating, but It took 4 years before one of us actually started a new relationship. So somewhere between 6 and 10 years, depending on how you look at it.
Was there other open action, like maybe swinger style behavior? Was it still monogamous in action?
So we have been together since 2000. Mm-hmm. And we were monogamous for the first 4 years of our relationship. And then when we decided to open our relationship, we weren't exactly sure how that was going to look. But we... our initial thought was that we were going to be swingers. And mm-hmm. We had read Dan Savage's book, Skipping Toward Gomorrah, and mm-hmm. there's a chapter in there about swinging. And we thought, you know, this seems like a very safe, structured way to, you know, have some sexual variety without sort of risking our relationship, without exposing ourselves to a lot of sort of emotional entanglements. And we didn't explore that for very long. We joined a couple of swingers groups online. We went to a swingers party, and we realized pretty quickly that casual sex really doesn't do it for us, mm-hmm. that we really need some sort of emotional connection mm-hmm. In order for to really enjoy sex. And so then we thought, well, so that was a lot scarier in a lot of ways. And so we had some negotiation around that. And we went on a few dates. Like, we were on, this was back in 2004, we were on the Onion Personals, and I don't know if you remember those, but, so, you know, we went on a few dates from that, and nothing really panned out. We were in a really small town, and...
Oh, one of those.
Yeah, we were in a little rural town out in rural Washington, and, we moved to Vancouver, Canada, and connected with the poly community there, and that was when things really started to, you know, accelerate for us, both in terms of meeting people, learning about more about polyamory, and figuring out what we wanted out of our relationships.
Oh, wow. So, okay. Yeah. All right. And the 6 years just running strong.
Yep.
Making no mistakes. Doing it perfectly.
Yeah.
If only.
How about you, Franklin?
I've always been non-monogamous. I've never been in a monogamous relationship in my life.
How old were you when it started?
When I was in high school, I took 2 dates to my high school senior prom, mm-hmm. which raised a few eyebrows, but I've actually never understood monogamy. Like, I remember being 6 or 7 years old and, you know, I was at school and the school teacher was talking about this story where this beautiful princess was being wooed by 2 princes. And I was like, well, princesses live in castles, right? And castles are big enough for 3 people, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't get it. Why is she trying to make this choice? So I've never been monogamous. Monogamy's never really made sense to me at all.
Interesting. I mean, definitely questions for me growing up. I definitely didn't understand why. Like, do you remember the movie Pearl Harbor? I mean, it was really big. Cuba Gooding Jr. was in it. Ben Affleck.
Never saw it.
Yeah, I never saw it.
That's totally fine. There is a love triangle in that movie. It's a subplot. I mean, you know, there's World War II stuff going on. But the subplot is that there's a girl back at home and the 2 best friends are in love with her, as far as I remember. And there was the thing where, how are we going to resolve this if, like, one... I don't know if one has gone off to war or, like... For some reason, one's gone, she falls in love with the other one. Oh, that's dramatic. But then they're in love. And then how do we figure this out? And it, like so many stories, spoiler alert, fast forward 20 seconds, they kill one of the characters.
Of course, because that's what Hollywood does.
It's like, you think, oh, crap, now we're in this poly situation that could actually, in some circles, be wonderful. Oh, no, we've got to kill somebody. Yep. Okay, so
there are so many stories like that.
Yes.
Recently, Frozen is an example of a movie that just
bothered me.
It should have been a poly story. It would have been a much better story if if they had...
Disney lost their nerve.
Yeah.
Right. And then there was that plot twist and da-da-da.
That came out of nowhere and nobody really believed.
It was totally random.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting like that. Yeah. Okay. So obviously we are touching on the fact that the narrative that we have been told through, whether it's a sci-fi fantasy story or, I mean, some sci-fi is actually pretty great in terms of being like outside the realms of monogamy or Disney stories or, I mean, action, romantic comedy. It's always romantic. You know, I'm a child of the 90s. So there was a lot of Meg Ryan and Sandra Bullock going on for me. Like, do you even get to watch movies and TV shows without throwing something at the TV? Because it's always... I remember that... Do you know that movie Drinking Buddies? It's on Netflix. Mm. Olivia Wilde's. It's kind of an indie movie, but it's been getting a lot of, like, kind of... Yeah. You know, there have been conversations about it. The trailer, if you look at the trailer of Drinking Buddies, it hints at polyamory.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah, where there's two different couples and there's... You know, some sort of attraction. There's a best friend relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, in the two couples, and I'm just like, oh snap! Here it comes, indie movies. We're gonna get into it. And then I watched it, and I was like, you guys totally just fucked with me. Like, yeah. You guys are just, you know. So how do you
deal
with that?
There always seems to be some need to sort of. It's like. You see films that kind of walk up to that line, and then it seems like there has to be a moral lesson somehow. Like, this has to go horribly wrong.
They have to chicken out.
Yeah, the movie Her is another example of that, you know, where
there was the
threesome setup, and it, you know, like, there were lots of ways that could have been done where it did not need to go the way it did, but it was like Hollywood just couldn't deal with a situation where there is, like, you know, a positive, healthy threesome that doesn't end in drama. Mm-hmm. So we got something else.
Well, we have to reinforce the cultural narrative, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's only one right way to do relationships, and especially one right way to do sex, and you can't step outside that line. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that, I mean, in your perspective, do you feel that some people just are monogamous, or do you feel like everyone's just sort of in denial?
So, I feel like I am intrinsically polyamorous, or at least intrinsically non-monogamous. Like, I don't feel like it would be possible for me to be monogamous and mm-hmm. be happy. I've met people who say they are intrinsically monogamous and they could not be happy any other way, and I have certainly no reason to doubt them. Mm-hmm. And then I've met a lot of people who, in the right circumstances and with the right partners, they could be happy monogamous or happy in a poly relationship. So mm-hmm. I think it's all part of the normal variability of the human condition.
And nice answer.
I think also there's a distinction between polyamory and non-monogamy. So mm-hmm. I think there definitely is some sort of inherent personality trait that is like either, you know, you tend to only want one partner or you tend to want more than one partner. And mm-hmm. then along the more than one continuum, there's like maybe I want two or maybe I want lots. But polyamory is really a culture and an ethical system. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of channeling non-monogamy. Franklin actually has a graphic on his website called The Map of Non-Monogamy that shows maybe not all, but a large proportion of the different ways that non-monogamy can be expressed.
Is that the most complicated Venn diagram ever that was ever created? I've seen that around. It cracks me up. I love it, though. It's like, monogamous unless we were outside 50 miles from each other. Like, there's all these different things. Eve, you bring up a really good point that it's different than non-monogamy. Could you lay out some of the basic definitions or of like what is polyamory versus non-monogamy versus swinging versus an open relationship? Those are four big categories. Or is non-monogamy an umbrella category of those other three?
Well, non-monogamy is any version of having more than one sexual partner or romantic partner, basically. Okay. So it can include cheating. Cheating is a form of non-monogamy, right?
Okay. Perhaps not an ethical form.
Right. The Venn diagram has dozens, but common ones are cheating, swinging, which is where you have swinging is basically a recreational activity that couples engage in with single people or with other couples, where it's, you know, very strictly limited to sex, often in a structured sort of party setting, not always. Mm-hmm. There's also polyamory tends to be. You know, relationships, multiple romantic, emotional relationships. Mm-hmm. Those relationships may not all include sex. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of asexual people who are drawn to polyamory as well.
That kind of makes sense, actually. I haven't covered asexuality yet. I was just sent a book on asexuality. I'm getting ready. I'm going to find an expert, and we're going to do this. So I'm excited.
Thanks, we have some experts that we can refer you to.
Yeah, please refer me some folks.
You want to give some other examples, Franklin?
So of non-monogamy?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. So, you know, you're talking
about that
movie Pearl Harbor, and it actually has been for a very long time common for military families to have arrangements where when the man is on deployment or is otherwise unavailable, his wife is sort of tacitly allowed to have other sexual partners with the expectation that when he comes back, mm-hmm. Those other partners will go away. And I mean, that dates back to World War I. That was common.
Well, and there's a history of what they would call wife swapping, particularly in the Air Force, as I understand mm-hmm. it.
Yes.
Like really, literally, parties, well, like key party kind of things?
No, less formal in structure than that, I think. But yeah. again, you know, if one is away, there's sort of a tacit agreement that the other one can
take care of the other. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Take care of her needs. Yeah.
It's interesting that, you know, morality really in a lot of ways comes down to what's practical. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're in times of war, when you got people who are away for long periods of time, it's not practical for to be monogamous. So, you know, there's sort of this tacit nudge, nudge, wink, wink arrangement around non-monogamy. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do consex where they'll say, we're totally monogamous. We're not interested in other partners. Unless we're at a science fiction con.
Or Burning Man.
Yeah. And then all rules are off. And then, you know, we leave the con and we go back to this safe sort of enclosed monogamy again. That's surprisingly common.
There's a 100-mile rule is common. So if we're more than 100 miles away from each other, we can have sex with other people. But again, an expectation that is not going to be an ongoing thing.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Over-the-road truckers will sometimes do that kind of arrangement.
Truckers, I love it.
Yeah. Don't ask, don't tell is really common. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can have you can have sex with other people, but don't tell me anything about it and I won't ask you.
And don't bring them home.
Yeah. So in polyamory, there's also a variant of polyamory called polyfidelity, which is, it's similar to monogamy in that it is a closed group or a closed relationship with an
closed
expectation.
Circuit, like
that,
an electricity.
Yeah, with an expectation that you won't have other partners, but it's more than two people. So you might have a three-person or a four-person polyfi unit. Yeah.
Do people use the word tribe a lot for that? I always hear tribe. I didn't know if that's a
sometimes.
People.
I've seen some people use that word. It seems to be less common now than it was, I don't know, 5-10 years ago.
Okay. I need to get updated. I want to be on the front line of understanding what's going on right now in
poly. The language changes really fast.
Yeah, it does. And depending on your geography, too, man.
Some people like the word family or polyfamily. We've talked about that. We talk about that a bit in the book and a bit on the blog as well. So there are pros and cons to that phrase as well. So.
Okay, so we covered non-monogamy, and you mentioned what swinging is, and polyamory. Did we cover, and you mentioned cheating. Were there any others that you feel like are important? I mean, polyfidelity, which is, I'm glad that you mentioned that geometry.
Well, one that I guess is culturally important is religious polygamy. That is, you know, typically a man who has multiple wives, and it's usually not an egalitarian situation. There's usually it's usually very patriarchal, hierarchical. So, for example,
FLDS, for example,
FLDS.
They do.
Yes.
And certain Muslim traditions as well. So, so that is, you know, another form of non-monogamy. That would technically be called polygyny.
Polygyny.
Mm-hmm.
Many women.
Polyandry, which is a woman who has multiple husbands, but the husbands are not allowed to have other partners, is very, very rare. There's a couple of places in Tibet, I understand, that still practice it, but it's really becoming uncommon.
Yeah, my understanding of polyandry is that it's usually several brothers where a lot of them are traveling for trading and whatnot, and so they share the same one. Really, when I was an anthropology major, I remembered that term because I just thought, because the truth is that it's not like she's like, yeah, I got all these husbands. It's like you just have more laundry to do, really. So polyandry is like much laundry.
There's actually a word for the polyandry with brothers, and I can't remember what it is.
Really?
Yeah.
Subset. Oh, we love our words, don't we?
Yes.
Okay, so we've got, let's get into the nitty gritty, as you say, about it. What makes it work? If a lot of these books talk about the philosophy and the theories of poly, and you wanted to get into it, what was it? Because you've mentioned, as I said, all these mistakes. And I feel like maybe these mistakes led to understanding and learning what actually makes it work. Because for me, like what I hear from people is you need Google Calendar.
Yes.
And I can barely figure out how Google Calendar works. If anyone's gone to my sexnerdsandra.com calendar of upcoming events. They know that I barely understand things on the internet. So,
although Google Calendar contains its own pitfalls, as we discuss in the book, so you need to combine Google Calendar with clear communication around expectations as well.
Clear communication, which was not happening in the movie Her.
Yeah,
when Robot Lady and Human Man. There was no emotional acknowledging.
So
communication's hard.
Yeah, we spend two chapters on communication. So we have a chapter on all the ways communication can go wrong, and then another chapter on ways that you can help communication go well.
Okay.
So, and then we recommend a couple more books on communication.
Are there any tidbits in communication that you've never heard anyone else really talk about? Because there's the acknowledge your feelings, and there's, you know, how about know your difficult conversation, a way of saying that?
Well, in the poly literature, you don't hear a lot of people talking about the pitfalls of passive communication or triangular communication.
Oh, God.
What's that?
Are you asking what's passive communication?
Both of them.
Do you want to talk about passive communication?
Is that like, you didn't ask, so I didn't tell you? That kind of thing?
Well, passive communication is more like, you know, you're communicating not directly, but you're communicating in the subtext. Like you say, it's been a long time since we've gone out to eat, instead of, wow, I would really like to go out to eat. Or, you know, don't you think it's time that you did something about the cat box, instead of, the cat box is full and I would really like you to empty it.
Or maybe
it sounds indirect. Is it indirect?
Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
Luisa Leontiades, who has the website Multiple Match, as well as a couple other sites, has done a review series of more than two, and she did a review article on the communication chapter, and she talked about, so she is originally British, and she talked about passive communication in British culture. And
is that really big in British culture?
Yes.
Yeah. Really?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah. She talked about the last biscuit problem, which is a great example of passive communication. So it's, you're at tea with somebody, and you have the last, you're down to the last biscuit on the plate, and I would ask you, would you like the last biscuit? That is actually my way of telling you, I would like the last biscuit. So you are supposed to say, oh, no, I couldn't possibly, so that then I can take the last biscuit, because I just passively communicated
to you. I've done that with French fries.
Yeah. So, and she says the worst possible thing you can say to a British person in response to that question, would you like the last biscuit, is, are you telling me that you would like the last biscuit? Because then you're calling them on their passive communication.
Oh,
and
no,
that's completely, completely unacceptable. So that's an example of, so it's code, basically.
You just laid out everything. Like, really, that is so clear, because, you know, like dating and like lots of things, people don't understand all the subtext and all the cultural, like the rules. Is an important rule that, I mean, American culture, we do this. But then I sometimes, in different circumstances, will say, like, oh, are you telling me that this is important for you? And people get flustered and they go, oh, I was too direct. I don't know how to be indirect. That's great. What's her name? Sandra? Or no, not
her name is Luisa Leontiades, and her her sites are, she has Postmodern Woman and Multiple Match, and then she writes for HuffPo as well.
I mainly just like the sound of her last name.
Yeah. She wrote a memoir called The Husband Swap that we gave away as part of our crowdfunding campaign as well.
So that's passive communication.
Yes.
Or indirect. Oh, passive. Passive is what you call it. And then what is triangular communication?
That is when you, so let's say.
You guys are smiling and laughing at each other.
Let's say that Franklin is my partner and he's also your partner.
Okay.
I have a problem with Franklin, but I don't want to, for whatever reason, I don't want to go to Franklin to discuss it directly. So I might come to you and.
Like, oh no, I do this all the time. I'm
telling you what my problem is with Franklin in the hopes that you will then try to fix the problem by going to Franklin for me and telling him about it. So instead of me taking my problem to him, I've taken it to you, and then it gets back to him. And then you might start advocating for me with him, or maybe advocating for him with me. That's triangular communication. And it can create some really messed up dynamics. And it's so common. I mean, it's common in every kind of interpersonal dynamic. I mean, you see it with parents and kids. You see it with siblings and parents. It's, you know, you
office politics. Office politics, mm-hmm. big yeah. time.
Oh, definitely. No, I think a lot of, I mean, well, I'm just projecting onto other people because mm-hmm. I do that.
Yeah, it's so easy to do.
It's hard not to do that. And mm-hmm. it's hard to break the habit if you're in the habit of communicating that way.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But there's also the issue of wanting to be able to express yourself and process with somebody who knows everyone involved. Mm-hmm. Can you, without hoping that they talk to the person that you're having an issue yeah. with, how can you do these two things? Is it don't ever do these two things or do them and create better structure around what your intention is?
I think it's fine to process with other people, although you have to be mindful of the relationship. So, for example, maybe I shouldn't come if you are my metamor. Now, for those who don't know, metamor is your partner's other partner. So
metamor,
we're sharing,
vocabulary.
Yes. So we're sharing Franklin. So if we're sharing him and I'm having a problem with him, maybe I shouldn't be going to you mm-hmm. with my problems with Franklin.
Okay.
Necessarily, or you know, maybe I shouldn't be going to Franklin with my problems with you because that's going to create some strain. So mm-hmm. I could go to someone outside our triangle mm-hmm. to process, or I could say, you know, I could explicitly say, I am not hoping. You know, I can tell you that this is not triangular communication.
Okay.
That I would like your input on how I can take this issue up with Franklin, but I am not asking you directly or indirectly to take it up with him, and then ask your consent to be my sounding board.
Okay.
Because
okay.
You may have a hard time setting that boundary. If I tell you my problem with Franklin, you may not feel comfortable knowing about that problem without being able to talk to him about it. So then you could tell me, you know what, please don't discuss it with me.
And in passive communication, mm-hmm. is it just don't do that ever? Because I feel like if everything is direct communication, I'm not going to make up as if I know what the solution is. What do you do? I mean, can you still, you just never be passive in your communication?
It seems like it works best when you're more direct, then the more direct you can be, the better the results tend to be. Mm-hmm. Passive communication succeeds when everybody is on the same code book, when everybody understands the same subtext. And mm-hmm. that's actually less common than you might think it is. It's really difficult to do that.
Mm.
Unfortunately, where people go overboard is they'll say, oh, well, you know, direct communication means this radical honesty thing, which basically means that I can say anything I want as long as it's true, and I don't have to be compassionate. I don't have to be aware of the impact of my words on other people,
I
and
see.
That gets a little messed up.
What would you call that kind of communication?
Being an asshole.
Okay.
But direct communication, as long as you're mindful, as long as you know what your intent is, as long as you are compassionate, seems to be the best communication tool.
Like speaking to your desire.
Yeah, advocating for your needs. And a big part of direct communication is listening to what your partner says. Don't assume subtext. Don't look for the hidden meaning in what they say. Listen to them. Ask questions if you don't understand. You know, ask clarifying questions and assume that they're telling you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I think a lot of people miss the listening component of direct communication.
Mm-hmm.
They assume that if they're saying what they think, they're communicating directly. But if they're also saying what you think, then they are not communicating directly.
Yeah, there is that jump in assumption. When mm-hmm. you leave room for assumptions
mm-hmm.
and a small ability to mind read,
mm-hmm.
you definitely...
And that will mess you up. I mean,
yeah.
I can't speak for any of your listeners, but I know my magic mind reading ruby that I usually keep in my forehead has never been reliable.
Ah, it's so difficult. Okay, so that's communication stuff. Are there any other major communication pitfalls?
Can you see the book?
You can totally look at your own book. I mean, you did triangular. Have you both done this triangular communication?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's a human thing. It's hard not to.
There is very little in this book that one or the other of us have not actually done ourselves in one way or another.
What's one of your biggest mistakes that you really regret? I mean, we don't need to get like deep into the darkest parts of your soul or anything. I mean, unless you want to go there, but
well, some of the deepest, darkest parts of my soul are actually in this book.
Oh.
Some of the big mistakes I've made, assuming that I could deal with problems like jealousy or people who are partners of mine feeling insecure by setting rules.
Okay.
That was huge because when you do that, you end up disempowering people, and it's really dangerous to disempower people you love in relationships with them.
Now, wait a minute. Is that like, ooh, I have a terrible rage, jealousy thing come up if you bring your other partner into our bedroom and have sex in our bed? So the rule is no outside partner sex in our bed. That seems like, because a lot of people will have that our bed policy, like go elsewhere for play. Would that be an example?
We spend a lot of time in the book distinguishing between. Sorry, did you want him to finish?
Oh no, I just. Okay. I mean, no. It's I was just wanted to know.
Yeah. So in the book, we just spend a lot of time distinguishing between boundaries, agreements, and rules.
Oh, okay.
And boundaries concern access to you. So a boundary for me concerns access to me, my body, my thoughts, my emotions, my personal space, and the things that belong to me, which would include my bed, my room.
Okay.
If I consider my bed to be my personal space and I have boundaries around access to that space, then that's okay to set that boundary and say, you know what, I'm not comfortable with anyone but you in my bed.
Mm-hmm. And what were the other two?
Agreements and rules.
Oh, agreements and rules. Okay.
Yeah. Do you have anything?
Yeah, the distinction between agreements and rules that we make in the book, the way we use the words are rules are strictures that are placed on somebody else, their behavior, their access, whatever, that they don't have a seat at the negotiating table. So they're not involved in making them.
Ah.
Whereas agreements are negotiations between all of the people who are affected. So, for example, I was with my ex-wife for 18 years. Mm-hmm. She was monogamous. I was polyamorous. So there was a lot of tension built into our relationship, and she never really felt completely secure in our relationship. And so she kept making these rules to try to feel secure, and unfortunately that approach rarely works.
So the rules in this vocabulary is she was putting strictures on your behavior to make her feel safer.
And on behavior of my other partners. Like one of the rules that she wanted was you can never spend the night with another lover. You have to come back to me every single night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my partners did not have a voice in that. They didn't have a place at the table when that rule was laid down.
I see.
So that meant that, you know, if they had a need to spend that time with me, well, they didn't get it. And and really what I discovered was, you know, over the years, those kinds of arrangements really hurt people who are unfortunate enough to get close to me. Because, you know, you fall in love with somebody and you are forbidden to advocate for your needs.
Mm-hmm.
You're forbidden to say, well, I need this from you because there are all of these rules that were already in place. And you're sort of told, you know, you sign on to these rules or get the fuck out. You know, you knew the rules when you came aboard. So that's it. And that creates really hurtful, toxic environments.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I mean, honestly, it's so funny how much of this is also applicable to just any relationship.
Yes.
A friend of mine, we've actually gotten a lot of feedback that the book is useful for anyone, no matter how many partners they want.
And less than two? Just two.
Yep. And a friend of mine recently wrote to me and said, you know, this is really just sort of a grand theory of relationships, of which monogamy is just a special case.
Mm-hmm. This is exciting. This is really fun. Thank you for clarifying the boundaries versus agreements versus rules thing, because that was such a neat discovery. I feel like that's really important, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I know at least three people listening to this are like, oh my God, it's so helpful in my own relationship conversations.
So some people in polyamory will use the word boundary to actually describe a rule. So they'll be like, you know, like, Franklin can't spend the night with anyone but me. That's a boundary that I have, right? Some people will say that. That's actually, in our terminology, in the word way we define the words in the book, we would not describe that as a boundary, because that concerns Franklin's behavior and Franklin's other partners. It does not concern access to me, my space, and the things that I own.
I love that. Okay, because poly, I mean, people have been non-monogamous in different ways, you know, as you mentioned, for a very long time. But it's exciting because now that it's stepping a little bit more toward the mainstream, more people are exploring it. There's more tools. People seem to be getting a lot more sophisticated. It seems to be getting, it feels like, rapidly it's kind of in its late teens phase, and we're starting to get into like the early 20s. Like, it's getting a little more mature. It's still making a lot of mistakes. But the concepts are getting more complex and nuanced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just in the 3 years that I've done this podcast, it's been neat to see new ideas erupt. Mm-hmm. Have you seen a lot of changes in the last couple of years?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So I started going to poly discussion groups and being a poly organizer in the mid-1990s,
mm-hmm.
and the poly community has really grown up. Well, I say poly community, there's not, like, there is such a thing. There is not an overarching poly community. There mm-hmm. really isn't. But there are, you know, large groups of people who are doing this now, and there is sort of an evolving set of ideas about, well, we've tried that, it doesn't work, we've tried this, and it does, and we're getting, as polyamorous people, a better sense of what works and what doesn't. And it's exploding right now. Like, you know, it for many, many years, if you were polyamorous, you really had to struggle to find other people who were poly. You mm-hmm. really, and we worked really hard to try to build these communities. And now it's on Showtime, it's on Oprah Winfrey, it's on Montel Williams,
yeah.
you know, so there's this huge awareness of it now, which means that there are people just pouring into mm-hmm. the poly community from the outside now. And in a lot of ways, they have it a lot easier than we did because they have the benefit of all of these years of wisdom and all mm-hmm. of these mistakes we've made. Yeah.
Okay. So let's say someone is just like, let's say they're already in a relationship and they would really like to open it up, and maybe poly's for them. Maybe they tend to crush a lot, or how do you, okay, there's so many questions. I'm going to quick fire questions at you. Okay. So it doesn't have to be super deep. How does someone figure out if they're poly or if they just want to bone a lot of people?
We have – one of the things that we do in this book is we present questions to people, the questions to ask yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have an entire set of questions to ask yourself about are you poly? So first you need to figure out, are you monogamous?
What's your favorite color? Right? Who's your favorite actor?
Like, so, oh. You know, if you have if you do find yourself crushing on a lot of people or if you have, you know, a lot of interest in multiple sexual partners, that might mean that you're non-monogamous. It might not necessarily mean that you're poly.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask questions about, like, am I comfortable with the idea of multiple long-term partners? Am I comfortable with the idea of my partners having other emotional connections? Have I ever been in love with more than one person at the same time? Now, if the answer is no, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not poly, but mm-hmm. do I think I could be in love with more than mm-hmm. one person at the same time, or do I really believe deep down that there's just one true love for me,
mm-hmm.
for example?
Next question. Good answer. What mistakes are people bound to make? Like, is there like a mistake that people always make?
I can prevent jealousy by passing rules and imposing structures.
Okay.
I'm worried that I'll be jealous, so we're both going to date the same person, and she won't have any other partners, and that way nobody will be jealous. We both are going to have a rule that we will always have sex with the same partner. If you have sex with somebody else, that means I get to have sex with them too. That way we won't mm-hmm. be jealous.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's going to get along.
Yes.
So it's like
or everyone
over-control.
Should get along.
Like, I
yeah.
love structure. I think structure is wonderful. As a weird human with lots of chaos in my life, I'm like, any structure, love it. What do you do then if you can't just control everyone, just get along, and we're all going to have a great time, there's going to be no jealousy?
You do the one thing that actually comes most difficult in my experience to anybody in a romantic relationship. You sincerely trust your partner. You tell yourself, my partner values me. I have value. I am a person who adds to my partner's life. If I give my partner free rein to do absolutely anything, he will take care of me. He will cherish me. He will honor and support me because that's what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, is that hard to do.
It's terrifying. That's
yes.
not a fun answer, Franklin.
We ask a lot of our readers, you know. We ask our readers to have a lot of courage.
No, I mean, self-confidence and trust and knowing that you value. Because that's the thing. It's like, oh, they'll fall in love with someone else. They'll leave me. It's
mm-hmm.
you realize that you exist and are important in the world mm-hmm. and to these people.
Yeah, self-worth and trust really go hand in hand, actually.
Yep. And there's the thing, right? If you don't trust your partner to want to be with you, how can you trust your partner to obey the rules?
Oh. And you can't trust them to obey the rules. How can you trust them to do that? First thing you said.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. That's my, like, well, it's a big thought sound. Oh. Speaking of sounds, you both, when I came in here, you both have I mean, if you took yours off for the headphones, but you both wear animal ears.
We actually have a YouTube video about that.
Okay.
If you go to the More Than Two YouTube channel.
It's not quite finished yet.
Right.
Yeah, we're redoing the video. The short answer is they're sexually transmitted.
But my eyes are really big right now. What does that mean?
You start the story.
Okay. So I have a partner who lives in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I met her while I was waiting in line for the elevator in a hotel.
Girl, you look so poly.
So I'm sitting there waiting in line, and it's Easter, and she's carrying an Easter basket full of candy, and she's got a pair of black leather bunny ears on.
Mm-hmm.
And she's wearing a t-shirt that says, "Ouch is not a safe word." And she comes bouncing up to me, and she says, "I have candy. You have booty. Do you want to trade?"
Whoa.
And, you know, my parents told me this thing about strangers with candy, and I can never quite remember what that lesson was. I think they said strangers have the best candy or something like that. So I was like, yeah, sure. So we started dating.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we parted ways and she went back to the UK, she gave me one of her spare pairs of bunny ears as mm-hmm. a gift.
Aww.
So, you know, if you have a partner who gives you a ring, you wear the ring, right? If you mm-hmm. have a partner who gives you a necklace, you wear the necklace. And so I wear the bunny ears everywhere. And then I started dating Eve.
Yeah. So a lot of stories start with that sentence, actually.
And then I started dating Eve. Yes.
I have a boyfriend who wears bunny ears. Mm-hmm. And I had to kind of wrap my head around this when we started dating. And, you know, it's really interesting when you go out and walk down the street with a middle-aged guy in bunny ears, like, you get a wide range of responses, many of which are not particularly positive. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
"What?" Like,
it's funny. There's actually we thought this would be a really interesting citizen science project to like have people go out in animal ears all over the country and like map the responses as like positive or negative or. But I mean, a lot of people are just kind of befuddled by them, but other people are openly hostile. Other people think they're cute, but actually, so what I did was I was like, I wasn't always entirely comfortable, depending on the setting, going out with him with the ears, but like I wouldn't want to ask him to change that or mm-hmm. anything. So I was like, what would make me more comfortable? I know, I need my own pair of ears.
Solidarity.
So, mm-hmm. So I was dating a woman at the time who had compared me with a white cream point princess cat, is what she called me, a princess cat. And so I was like, well, I need white fluffy bunny ears. So I made,
kitty
or not,
ears.
Not kitty ears. Yeah. Right. I need white fluffy kitty ears. So I made myself a pair of ears. And it's actually funny. The percentage of cute to negative responses has gone way up since I started going out in the kitty ears with Franklin.
Interesting.
We get much, much more positive responses overall when we're both wearing the ears than mm-hmm. when just he is.
Because, you know, one person in animal ears is weird, but two people in animal ears are a party.
Yeah. It's kind of true. It's really is true. And this is not really even on topic, but what? Because I'm curious about a man wearing bunny ears. And they're little bunny. They're really cute. They have bunny ears. What were the hostile reactions? Did someone push you? Did they say something really mean out a window?
People will say things that are kind of snarky. When we're together and I'm wearing the bunny ears, they'll say things like, "Hey, shouldn't the ears be on her instead of you?" You know,
that's when I'm not wearing the ears.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. obviously, you know, wearing bunny ears has something to do with sex. I don't know. And a lot of glares. Lot of people will come up to me and say, "Wow, those are really cute." And then the other people, and it's usually women who do that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, usually men, will be like, "Well, what are those for?" And I was, where was I? I was in Utah, and I was wearing them. We stopped at a rest stop somewhere in Utah, and I got out of the car to go pee, and this middle-aged guy walked up to me and said, "What? You think you're some kind of funny bunny or something?"
It was ridiculous.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Straight face. Okay. Thank you for giving me more details. I'm just curious because it is a bit of a social experiment. Are you still with the British Bunny?
I am.
Okay.
And actually, I sent a pair of black alley cat ears to one of Franklin's partners in Florida as well as part of a care package that we made for her.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
She was having a rough time, so we sent her cookies and ears.
Aww.
Yeah.
In terms of ethics, Do you have like an ethical, like the Ten Commandments of ethical poly?
Just two.
Yes. And if you, I mean, could you leave us with sharing those and also what they came out of? Possibly, I feel like they probably didn't just come out of the ether one night, yeah. like stoned hanging out. I'm sure that.
So everybody always says, yeah, well, polyamory is ethical non-monogamy. And then you ask them, well, what does ethics mean? And they're like, well, you be honest. Okay, that's probably a good place to start. What else? So we thought, you know, ethical relationships really needed more than that. And we actually spent quite a lot of time sort of circling around, well, what do healthy relationships look like? What do positive, constructive relationships all have in common, mm-hmm. Regardless of whether they're poly or monogamous or whatever? And we eventually circled around to two basic premises that underlie everything else that we say about ethics. Number one is don't treat people as things.
Okay.
And number two is the people in the relationship are more important than the relationship is.
Okay, because that codependent thing where you're like prioritizing the relationship over
sacrificing core elements of yourself.
I see.
In the relationship.
So each person keeping their individuality as priority over the relationship.
Not necessarily keeping your individuality as priority over the relationship, but never sacrificing the self mm-hmm. for the relationship.
Okay. Yeah.
So those boundaries that we're talking about, like if you have core boundaries that are constantly being pushed or trodden in your relationship, then that mm-hmm. is a problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
And that axiom that people in the relationship are more important than the relationship actually came from one of Franklin's partners who wrote a guest blog post for us on consent. Mm-hmm. And it's mind blowing. It's so good. The title is On Consent and Romantic Relationships. And it's on our blog at morethan2.com. And when she wrote that and we read that, we're like, that's it. That is, you know, that's the core of our ethical system. And don't treat people as things is something that Franklin has been saying for a very mm-hmm. long time and is surprisingly controversial.
Were you yes. treated as a thing, Franklin? Did you treat somebody else as a thing?
Yes to both.
Oh.
So what can happen, this can happen in some incredibly subtle ways. Mm-hmm. You know, everything else that we talk about comes out of those. Like, why is it important to be honest in a relationship? Well, don't treat people as things. If I am seeing you as a way for me to get my needs met instead mm-hmm. of seeing you as a partner or as a person. If I am, for example, lying to you or withholding information from you in order mm-hmm. to get you to be in a relationship with me or to have sex with me or whatever, mm-hmm. I'm treating you as a need fulfillment machine. I'm
okay.
treating you as a thing. And we do that in some incredibly, incredibly subtle ways.
Okay. Like
it's,
what?
It's hard.
I need concretes because it gets so abstract sometimes when you talk about mm-hmm. this stuff. Like, what does that mean,
well,
the subtle ways?
Why, I was about to give an example of a non-subtle way, but
okay.
Cheating, for example. Cheating is I am withholding information from my partner that materially affects their ability to consent to be in a relationship
right.
with me. I am treating that partner as a thing.
Mm-hmm. And then what's the super secret ways people aren't even aware? Like, I was not aware of the vocabulary and the concepts around passive mm-hmm. and triangular communication, so that's really helpful. So how have I accidentally done this? Tell me everything.
What are some subtle ways that people treat other people as things? They consider their own needs to be more important than the needs of their partner. Well, you know, I know that you I really, really need you to drop your plans and do this thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
I am not even going to think about the needs of your other partners. Like, I know you had a date with somebody else scheduled for Friday night, but, you know, I'm feeling sort of insecure, so I need you to cancel that date and be with me.
Huh.
Well, you're disregarding the humanness, the essential agency of other people. You are saying, well, my needs come before your needs because you're not really a person. Your needs are not really equal to mine.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting about you saying that? Is, and maybe this goes back to the trust and self-esteem and valuing yourself thing, but I bet a lot of people treat themselves as things.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yes. I think that's probably
yeah,
really
reversal
true.
Reversal thinginess.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Yeah. Taking a partner for granted.
Yes.
You know, it becomes very easy, particularly in a long-term relationship or if you live together, to mm-hmm. sort of forget about the humanity of your partner, to forget mm-hmm. to really see them mm-hmm. as a person and start to see them as part of the furniture, mm-hmm. you know?
Or you see them as that thing that makes dinner every night when you get mm-hmm. home. And so if they cease to make dinner every night when you get home, well, they have just taken away something you're entitled to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, entitlement. No longer it's a... It used to be special. Yeah. Now it's just a mm-hmm. thing that happens.
Yeah, when we forget our partner's agency and forget that their being with us is a choice mm-hmm. And that they're giving us their time as a choice and start to think of ourselves as entitled to any part of them, their time, their intimacy,
their
a relationship with them, then we begin treating them as things.
Oh. This has been
hard.
Yeah. Hard. This has been so wonderful. I had all these notes and like we really got through some stuff. How do you guys feel about this? But do you feel like you covered, like, do you feel satisfied? Is there mm-hmm. something burning in your soul that you want to make sure to communicate in this conversation around the nitty gritty ethics and communication stuff?
Wow. That could fill up many conversations.
It could. Isn't that fun?
I mean, you know, we've got 500 pages and 150,000 mm-hmm. words of nitty gritty. So there's much room for more conversation around this kind of thing. Ethics and good treatment in relationships. This stuff is hard.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there something that like a baby poly person out there just like going, okay, so I've learned about the communication thing and some of the poly concepts and don't treat my partner as a thing. And is there anything else you think would be like, oh, just like delicious and like they could just really take and put into action so that the next 6 months, they maybe their life isn't totally just destroyed by all their mistakes?
Don't try to treat people like training wheels. A lot of newcomers to poly will be like, well, you know, it's okay if you're advanced and you've got all this poly experience to say, well, you know, don't use rules and structures to try to solve problems. But I need to learn to trust my partner. So we're going to have to take baby steps and do training wheels. And that's kind of like skydiving by mm-hmm. getting up in the plane and then saying, well, I don't really trust my parachute yet. So I'm not going to jump out. Instead, mm-hmm. I'm just going to crawl out onto the wing, you know, mm-hmm. and maybe hang onto the tail of the plane for a while until I trust my parachute. If you don't trust your partner, build that trust before you put other people's hearts in the line of fire.
Something I was going to say is also that it's you don't get to skip the self-work part of it. You really need to keep working on yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to cultivate self-esteem and a sense of self-worth and you know, to understand you deserve to be treated well. There are a lot of... it's common for poly people to propose arrangements that kind of don't end up treating people very well, mm-hmm. and you don't have to accept that. There are other options out there, mm-hmm. and, you know, you deserve to have something that works for you. So, you mm-hmm. know, a relationship that's working has to work for everyone.
And everyone doesn't mean just the couple who's opening up. Everyone means everyone involved.
Right, yeah. So often it's when you have a solid couple, they kind of treat everybody else as disposable. To mm-hmm. I've seen that for sure. God, there's so much.
We've talked a bit about couples, so I want to stress also something that Aggie Says, who writes the blog Solo Poly, said during our crowdfunding that polyamory is not something that couples do. It's something that people do.
Okay.
So, you know, not everyone who's poly is in a couple. There are people who are solo poly
and people who are networked poly.
Networked poly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just to keep that in mind as well, it's not all about the couples.
So that's more of a swinging concept mm-hmm. where you're like a team. Like, I think of swinging as kind of like team playing.
Yes.
Because you're prioritizing the couple over.
But you can be a team and also be in, you know, long-term, stable, romantic relationships with other people as well.
Okay. So. I feel like I just opened up a can of worms.
We'll
probably put the lid back on.
Yeah, we could easily do a dozen podcasts like this and not touch at all.
Mm-hmm. I had one last little thing. I mean, I'm sure you have plenty of resources in the book. Again, more than two. A practical guide to ethical polyamory. I was so the book was across the way. I was like, what's the colon? And more than two, a practical guide to ethical polyamory by Franklin Vo and Eve Rickard. For people who want to start dating, you mentioned that there's not like one community. There's lots of communities. Would you recommend FetLife? Would you recommend Plenty of Fish, OkCupid, where do people go to find, because there's a lot of secret Facebook groups, which means you can't join them unless you already mm-hmm. meet someone. So like, what are some decent ways? And of course, some people are in small towns, whereas other people mm-hmm. are in big cities.
It varies regionally. Like where I live in Vancouver, everybody's on OkCupid. That's where you find poly people.
Okay, so you need to find out what people are doing in your area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. FetLife is
hit or miss, depending on where you are.
And if you're kinky. Mm-hmm. Not everyone who's poly is, so...
OkCupid has been brilliant for me. I mean, I've met a couple of partners and many very good friends that way, and it's been awesome.
Something that we've discovered on OkCupid is that you have to answer around 1,200 or 1,300 questions.
Holy heck.
But if you get to that point, if you answer a lot of questions and anything that's poly-related, you mark as very important or as mandatory. Mm-hmm. If you get to that point... It's pretty much a guarantee that anyone who's at 90% or over match with you mm-hmm. will be either poly or very poly-minded.
Oh, that's a wonderful
Even if they don't list polyamory in their profile.
Oh, that's great.
Another good strategy, if it's something that's available to you, if you don't have, you know, concerns about, say, a child custody dispute or something like that, is just to be open about it. Mm-hmm. There's a Subway sandwich shop across the street from me, and you know, I'll go in there all the time because it's close, and the person behind the counter who was making my sandwich one day was like, oh, so what did you do this weekend? And I was like, well, you know, my girlfriend and I went to saw that movie, The Happening, and then afterward, her husband and her other boyfriend and his other girlfriend and I all went out to dinner. And she was like, oh, you're poly? So am I. You know, just being that open can make it so much easier to find people.
Do you get free cookies now?
I do not get free cookies. Boy, that would be nice.
That would be nice. I love it. How long have you two been together?
Two years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you made a baby.
Yes.
A book.
Yes.
It's like the same thing, basically.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. And how long are you on tour for?
Another month.
Yeah?
Yep.
Any particular dates? You're headed to New Mexico next, right?
Yep. So we're going to be in Las Vegas tomorrow, Saturday. Mm-hmm. And then morethan2.com/events has all of our bookings.
Okay.
And if you follow our Facebook page, we're announcing our bookings as we go. But it's Las Vegas, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Boulder, Denver, Paonia, Salt Lake City, and Missoula.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure when I'll post this, but I'll definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Post that link in the Nerdist bio section of stuff.
Right.
Oh, that's so exciting. Well, thanks again for coming out and talking with me.
Thank you.
It's been awesome.
As they say on the podcast, they say, that's me, I need more sleep. As we say on the podcast, go team fun. Thank you, guys.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.